I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The final presidential debate concluded last night. I think it's safe to say what happened in Vegas won't stay in Vegas. We'll hear from our local panel of undecided voters. Are they ready to support a Mr. or a Mrs. President? Then, more than 50 years have passed since the 16th Street Church was bombed in Birmingham, Alabama. The heinous act took the lives of four young girls. We'll hear from a survivor who felt the explosion. It killed her best friend, and she later forgave one of the bombers. Finally, Brian McTavish with this weekend's to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. We get reactions from our undecided voters from last night's final presidential debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Later, the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, was a defining event of the civil rights era. Four young girls died in the bombing, but a fifth girl who was standing nearby survived. She's written a new memoir, and we'll talk about it later on. But first, let's check in with KCUR's newsroom, and for that, let's bring in Kyle Palmer. And Kyle, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Steve.
I understand there have been two separate incidents this morning around the metro involving shootings and police.
Yeah, these are two ongoing situations. The latest one happened near 55th and Cambridge, which is in Kansas City, but near Raytown. A man reportedly shot at a Kansas City police officer who was driving in an unmarked car. Reports are now, at least the latest, that the police have surrounded a home in that area. No further word about whether they believe the suspect is inside that home. Really early this morning, just after midnight in Overland Park, a Lenexa police officer accidentally discharged his firearm in an alleged confrontation with a suspect in a Quick Trip parking lot. This was in Overland Park. The suspect fled, still at large. Not clear whether the suspect was injured in that exchange.
Okay, we'll get more reaction to the debate in just a moment. But any other election news from KCUR, our listeners should be on the lookout for today?
Yeah, we have some good in-depth coverage of Missouri's gubernatorial race on our website. Currently, a profile of GOP candidate Eric Greitens and his rise to political prominence, even though he is a political newcomer. And also a story about Chris Koster's 2007 party switch, people debating whether that was calculated politically or for genuine ideological reasons. Of course, Koster, one of the more prominent people to switch parties and run for governor in Missouri history. We also have a story about food issues as it relates to the presidential race. Surprisingly, both the Trump and Clinton campaigns agree about food issues. Most notably, they do agree food stamp benefits should be contained in the omnibus farm bill.
I thought you were going to say what kind of food they like the most or something, kind of like turkey or something.
Well, that might open up a whole other can of worms, but they do have this one piece, this one small piece of agreement.
Okay. Kyle, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
And now turning briefly to our resident legal expert here at KCUR, that's Dan Margulies. Dan, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
We wanted to talk to you because something very strange happened in the legal world in Kansas just yesterday. In a brief sent to the state Supreme Court, the state used the infamous Dred Scott case as support for an argument it was making in an ongoing dispute over abortion rights. We'll get to the case the state seemed to be trying to make in just a little bit. But first, remind us, Dan, why is the Dred Scott decision so reviled today?
Well, that is one of the worst, if not the worst, decision ever handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court by almost universal consensus. And the issue in that infamous 1857 pro-slavery decision by the United States Supreme Court was whether Dred Scott was entitled to freedom after he moved to a free state. And the court found that a black person whose ancestors were sold as slaves, as was the case with Scott, are not United States citizens deserving of constitutional protections and therefore have no standing to sue in federal court.
You know, just to be clear here, the state has now withdrawn that brief citing the Dred Scott case. What was the case it was trying to make, and why in the heck bring Dred Scott into it, Dan?
Why indeed? So earlier this year, just to refresh your recollection, Steve, the Kansas Court of Appeals in a split decision upheld a lower court ruling finding that the Kansas Constitution guarantees a right to an abortion. Now, the ACLU, which wants the Kansas Supreme Court to affirm that decision, to uphold that decision, likens the equal protection provision in the Kansas Constitution to that in the federal Constitution, in the 14th Amendment, and says it should be interpreted similarly, i.e., as the U.S. Supreme Court decided in Roe v. Wade, it guarantees a woman's right to an abortion. Mm-hmm. So in the brief that was withdrawn yesterday by the state of Kansas, in that brief opposing the ACLU's argument, the state of Kansas argued that the Kansas equal protection provision was inspired by the Declaration of Independence and that that document is aspirational rather than a statement of law. And in support of that proposition, it invoked a string of legal cases, a string of legal citations that included Dred Scott.
Wow, that's amazing. Dan Margulies, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. KCUR's panel of undecided voters met again last night to hear the final presidential debate. And just like the first two, we're going to get reactions to what they heard and see if they've decided on a candidate. But this time we're joined by the coordinator of these listening sessions and two of the panelists. Laura Ziegler is a reporter here at KCUR working with our community engagement team. Laura, always nice to have you.
Thanks, Steve. Good to be here.
Henry Lyons is in the real estate business and the head of the Johnson County NAACP. Henry, good morning.
That's Olathe, Overland Park, and Leawood NAACP.
Okay, gotcha. All those. And Becky Gilligan's also here. She works as an executive assistant for a family business, and both she and Henry are independent. Becky, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Well, Laura, you sat with the panel last night as they watched the debate. What were you hearing from them when the thing was over?
Well, I will say that it was definitely more subdued, our conversation here, than the previous two debates. I think you guys would agree. Kind of followed the general tone of the debate, which was a little bit less toxic. Everybody seemed to agree. That consensus was that people got more out of this debate, that it was more substantive than the other two, more issues were hit. But I will say that we really only had going into this, of the eight people we started with, a handful of undecideds, true undecideds. And then the others that we had were really leaning toward Clinton or Trump, but holding their nose.
Hmm. Henry Lyons, you sat through all three. Was this one, last one, a little more revealing than the other ones?
I thought the second one was just as revealing as the third one.
Oh, did you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's my personal opinion. Like she said, the third was more subdued, but as far as revealing, I think they both, the last two were both revealing to me.
Okay. Becky, how about you? Did you see more in this last one than the other two?
I think I saw the most in this last debate of things that actually concerned me as a voter, things that they really got into the pro-life issue, for instance. Mm-hmm. I'm very strongly pro-life, and I like that they finally really addressed that, and Trump actually said some things that he believed, because up until now, I hadn't heard that at all from him.
The debate actually began with that issue. That was early on in the whole forum, right?
Yes, they did mention it toward the beginning, and I'd heard Pence say a lot of stuff, but I hadn't heard Trump, so that was nice for me to hear.
Now, Becky, you came in as undecided, but leaning towards Trump. Do I have that right?
Yeah, but mostly because he's pro-life. And mm-hmm. I just wanted to kind of be open to the ideas that each of them had. But really, I came more into it, I didn't like either one of them. So mm-hmm. I was trying to look at both of them, what they had to say, to see if one of them would really impress me and stand out.
Did what you hear last night seal the deal for you? Or are you casting your vote for Trump? Or do you know
yet? I wouldn't say that for sure yet.
You're still on the fence.
I'm more leaning towards Trump of the two major candidates. But I think Trump still needs to really impress me that he's the one that will get my vote, as opposed to voting for someone like Evan McMullen or another third-party candidate.
Well, you've run out of debates here. There's no more debates to be looking
no,
at.
No, I know.
What are you going to be looking at to make up your mind?
I listen to the radio a lot, NPR.
That's a lot online. Yeah. I knew I liked you when I met you. Yeah.
I read a lot. I'm on the internet a lot, but of course you see stuff on the internet. You can read things all over the place. You have to look at the credibility of the sources that you're reading.
Yeah. I just want to say one thing, though. Last night it struck me that you said you didn't think you could vote for Hillary, but it really sealed the deal that you couldn't vote for her last night about what you heard. You spoke pretty strongly about that.
That is correct.
And why?
because she came out and really said, she's running on a lot of emotional, Henry said it well last night, like she's appealing to people a lot by her emotions, and I felt that by their emotions, and I felt that that was the case a lot last night. But she really affected my emotions when she talked about the abortion issue. And I was just very affected by that. And I thought, how can a mother, you know, I've heard of situations that are very, very sad where a mother has given birth to a baby privately, murdered the baby, and been in huge trouble with the law, mm-hmm. rightly so. But yet, if in that last trimester up to the very moment of giving natural birth, she were to decide to terminate the pregnancy, that would be fine. And that just hurts me. I feel that all people have a right, and I do feel that a baby has rights even before they're born. And I think
so that issue is cutting for you very
much
cleanly,
so. And
here,
if,
very personally.
Yeah, and
like,
if and I had heard that she was going to extend, she's for extending all taxpayers to pay for abortions, even people who are against it. And as a very strong pro-life candidate myself, I don't want to pay for other people's abortions.
You did say something that struck me too, just about her style. I think you said something like you thought she was kind of, was it snotty? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but something
I
about
said
her style.
Stubborn. She was very, I didn't say the word cocky last night, but in the second one, I thought she was. As the debates went on, in the beginning, she seemed more weak. I remember saying after the first debate that I was afraid Trump might be too strong of a leader where he wouldn't listen to other people, and Hillary was too weak. But as the debates went on, Trump actually seemed more subdued, and the most in this last debate where he mm-hmm. was actually calm and controlled and collected, and I like that. Whereas Hillary was very cocky and more offensive towards him, and I didn't like that.
Yeah. Well, Henry Lyons, after seeing all the debates and sleeping on it now, did one of the candidates come out as the better choice for you, or are you still up in the air?
Still up in the air, but what worries me about Hillary is the fact that the evasiveness. She's been asked numerous times, why did you delete the 33,000 emails, and she never has an answer. She just ignores it and just acts like the question was never asked. Mm-hmm. Another thing that she was evasive about, and I'm not promoting Donald Trump, I'm just saying when I deal with people, I notice these things.
Right, sure.
She was asked, now I skipped my mind, but it was another question she was asked, and also still she was evasive about it. So that's what bothers me. But what really concerns me above all this is the fact that I don't know if either one of them can govern after they win. Mm-hmm. And that bothers me because the country is very, very divided. I mean, you've divided emotionally. And if the people split their tickets, so to speak, and vote for Hillary and still vote Republican Congress like we have now, she's not going to be able to govern. If Trump wins, there's going to be so much emotion on the Democratic side that even if they don't control the House, they're going to be causing problems for him. So I'm really wondering about how is the country going to really govern? How is anyone going to govern a country divisive as it is now?
Yeah, I was really struck by the fact they didn't shake hands after the end of the final debate. And people look to that as a signal. And obviously, lots of talk about the headline out of last night's debate for a lot of news outlets was this idea that Donald Trump saying he's not sure, you know, he can get behind Hillary Clinton if, in fact, she ends up winning this race. What did you all make of that? I mean, to Henry's point, this idea of can we move ahead as a country regardless of who wins this thing?
Well, to me, I dislike his hypocrisy. And the shaking hands, to me, even with an athletic contest, is sort of a hypocrisy. You are on the court or the field. You're trying to demolish this other person, and at the end you're supposed to go up and say, oh, nice game and all this. And being an athlete myself, I know that in your mind you really don't feel that way. And so to me, I would rather them not shake hands and show that they really have problems with the other person than to be two-faced and shake your hand in the same time they want to stab you in the back. So to me, that was a sign of honesty to me and to my way of thinking.
Becky, how did it strike you? This notion
I guess that kind of makes sense, what Henry said. I hadn't really thought about that before, but I don't like hypocrisy. I really would have liked to have seen him, when they asked that question, say what he had said in the first debate, that he would accept the outcome of the election, and so did Hillary in the first debate. I remember them both saying that, and that was encouraging to hear, that somebody was supportive. Even mm-hmm. if they didn't win, they wouldn't be a sore loser. I also thought it was telling that, in a way, I mean, lately in the news, they've been talking a lot about Trump saying how he thinks the elections are rigged. And it was ironic last night that Hillary was talking about the Russians getting into the voting situation. Right. In a sense, she thinks the elections are rigged as well, if you know, if because they're in favor of Trump, she thinks. So I was kind of like, well, they're both thinking that the elections may be rigged. That's weird.
Basically, we have two undecided voters who came into these debates as undecided, and we're sitting here today. You two are still sort of undecided today.
Yeah,
sort of. Even
correct.
After 90 minutes times three, you know, of debates here, Laura.
Yeah. I was just going to say about the, you say the headlines about what Trump said about him not accepting the election, and you bring up the Hillary position about Putin being involved and Trump's connection to Putin. I think those two things dovetail, you know, and I think Trump pundits have said he needs sort of college-educated white women to help sway him, and I think he hurt himself is what I understand from, you know, pundits say, and I think that connection between the perception that he's somehow connected to Russia and that he can't accept the results of the election is this sort of notion that it's non-democratic, that it goes against the values of our country. And
can
our
I
country.
Interject something on that right there? That was the second point I was making about the evasiveness, because to me it didn't matter how the WikiLeaks information, where it came from or how they got it. The question to me was, is it true or not? Mm-hmm. In other words, police arrest people and solve crimes and bust crime organizations every day because of informants. They don't say who the informant is, but they are proven in court that the case is true and the person gets convicted. So it matters not to me whether it was a Chinese, Japanese, somebody in a hut in Brazil. What matters to me was this true? And they have not denied that those leaks were false. They didn't say they weren't. So to me, that was evasiveness. That was trying to change the public's opinion to an emotional one. Russia's going to attack us or something.
So is Hillary off your list, Henry?
Not off my list, but I don't like the evasiveness.
Yeah, I'm not hearing a lot of love here.
I know. I hate to be defending Trump all the time, and that's why I asked another question. And I still would like, maybe out during the course before the election, I get to talk to someone, because a lot of people out here to support Hillary, I don't realize what it is that they don't like about it. Like, I can name things about Trump I don't like. I think he's bombastic. I think he's a little edgy. I don't think he was prepared enough for the debate last night. But being objective, I can say that. But I want to hear somebody that loves Hillary tell me what are the three things or four things they don't like about her, because nobody's perfect.
Yeah.
That's
well, Laura, what about the rest of the panel? How many were swayed one way or the other as a result of these debates?
Well, Steve, it was pretty split evenly down the line. Lest you think that we had everybody leaning Trump, a couple people came in, as I said earlier, leaning toward Hillary. We were missing a few of the ones we started with. But like Henry, a couple said that they still didn't know. They would be doing some more research. I guess Becky's in that category as well. Here's Leroy Grubbs talking about that. Let's listen.
My name is Leroy Grubbs, and in watching these debates, it's really very important for me to make a decision based upon informed perspective. In the two or three moments that they get to make a presentation and just trusting completely in that, I still feel great responsibility for my choice, and I would like to look further into the details of it. Over the next few weeks before the election, I'm sure I will find out a lot more facts and details to be able to make the decision. Yes, the direction of our country is of greatest importance to me.
On the other hand, we had a handful of others, several who left and were persuaded at the end of this three debate all around different issues for different reasons. Let's listen here to Rob Givens.
This is Rob Givens, and I think the thread for the three debates that we've watched, this was the debate we should have seen three times. It was much more controlled and less toxic. I was undecided. I'm a lifelong Republican. I wanted a Republican candidate. But I think the issues that have come up outside the debates proper, particularly in the last several days regarding that everything's rigged, and he's got so many people backpedaling on what he's saying in terms of that he means that the voting, and yet that's been debunked by, you know, qualified people in terms of it doesn't happen often. And I'm a supervising judge at one of the Johnson County elections, and I have seen the voting process, and it isn't going to be rigged. That is a basic shot at democracy. And while I would like to be able to find a single issue, be it Iraq, ISIS, abortion, guns, whatever, the world is way too complex for that.
Hmm. So, Henry and Becky, what concerns you most as we move forward to these last few weeks of the campaign? We're roughly 2.5 weeks out now. I mean, your decision time is looming here. I hate to break it to you. You don't have a whole lot of time left to make up your minds. Henry?
Well, Becky and I decided we're going to draft Pence.
Are you?
I thought about it.
Becky and I agree on that. We like Pence.
People have said that. Other people have said that.
We like Pence, but we know that would never carry any substance at the voting.
Have you thought about writing his name in, Henry?
No, because I know it would be as if I didn't vote. But 4 years from now, who knows what his position would be. I need to, just as Becky said, pay attention to what's going on. I listen to Fox and CNN and try to get the true message from both of them. And who knows what's going to come up in the news. But I have to clarify something, at least from my perspective, about Trump's remark about the election is rigged. What I gathered from that is that there are certain news media in this country, New York Times for one, let's just don't beat around the bush, who actually, from what I can tell, and I read it sometime myself, are swayed toward Hillary, and they're not being objective about it. And, and I think that's what he is saying when he says rigged, because I do not want the media to decide who runs the country myself. I think that that's not right, and I think they should be more objective. So just that's my clarification on what he means by rigged. I don't think he means people are going to go to the Black Panthers did in Philadelphia, stand outside the voting area, and they intimidated people. That would happen in the last election. Well, so I don't think he means that. I think he means that the media is rigging it.
Well, he might do a service to the country by explaining what he means by rigged, because a lot of people are very concerned about
that as we
stand
here.
Yeah. Becky, how about you? These final weeks, what are you looking for? What are you expecting?
Well, honestly, for me, it's down to either Trump or Evan McMullen, like I said, who I only just learned of this week, or honestly writing in Pence's name if I really feel that neither one of the major candidates deserves my vote.
But what about Henry's point that if you go the non-mainstream candidate route, you're wasting your vote?
Well, I've thought of that, but if I feel like I can't really get behind either one of the major candidates, if I really feel like I just can't vote for Trump, if it comes down to that, then I want to just leave that in the hands of the rest of the voters and vote for somebody that maybe somehow word will get out that this other person actually had more support, this third party candidate, than they would expect. I know Evan McMullen has this idea that the only way that he could get elected is if he gets, I guess, Utah, and then Trump and Hillary, because it's such a close tie,
right,
if they don't get enough electoral votes, then it'll go to the House or whatever.
That's called a triple bank shot.
Yeah, and that's
I'm not real sure that's likely to happen.
I don't think it is either, but I think otherwise it would be impossible if we didn't have that situation. So I really don't know.
Just a final point. How confident are the two of you that the country can move ahead regardless of who wins? As we sit here today, the debates are over. The country still, there's still a lot of divided folks out there. People split on this question. Henry, what do you think? Can the country move ahead with the winner, whoever
America
it is?
America survived for over 240 years. It got through Jefferson and Hamilton. We will survive. But there again, as I said before, I don't know how people will be governed. It will be polarizing. But America will survive, always will, and always has.
Becky?
I agree with Henry. I think that's true.
Okay. Well said. Okay. Well, I want to thank Henry Lyons and Becky Gilligan, who were good enough to participate in our Undecided Voters panel. Thank you both very much. Laura Ziegler from KCUR's Community Engagement Team. Always appreciate it, Laura.
You're welcome.
Okay. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk to a survivor of the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing back in 1963 in Birmingham, Alabama. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday we learned how music is helping underprivileged kids stay in school. Then Breaking Bad's Bryan Cranston talked about his award-winning career. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow we'll speak with Jason Kander, the Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate from Missouri. Well, Carolyn Maul McKinstry can't forget. And so she's written her story of what it was like that day in September 1963 when a bomb exploded inside the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, killing four little girls. Carolyn was standing just a few feet away when the bomb erupted. She tells her story of that morning and what it was like to grow up in the Jim Crow South in a book, While the World Watched, A Birmingham Bombing Survivor Comes of Age During the Civil Rights Movement. She'll talk about her life tonight at Avila University. More on that in just a few minutes. Carolyn Maul McKinstry, so nice to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you.
I don't think anybody would forget a morning like the one you experienced on September 15th, 1963. To what extent do the events of that morning haunt you even today?
Well, as you might expect, I remember them quite vividly. And while I have overcome quite a few things, it's always in the recesses of my mind. Mm-hmm. As I see much of the discord that seemingly is still there around our nation, I think back to those events and just am always very hopeful that we can at some point rise above that discord.
Tell us about getting ready for church that morning, because it's in the book, and that told me so much about your family. Such an interesting tale.
Mm-hmm. Well, that morning, I arrived at church about 9:30. I served as secretary of the Sunday school.
That was quite an honor for a 14-year-old girl.
It was. Right? It was, and I accepted it as such. I was very diligent about collecting the offerings and taking the attendance and so forth. And I was on my way upstairs to collect the remaining information from the adults upstairs. I had to pass the bathroom where the girls were. Mm-hmm. I did see the four girls there. I spoke to them. They were all friends of mine. Cynthia Wesley's father was my grade school principal, grades 1 through 8.
And one of the girls was your best friend.
That was Cynthia Wesley.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Denise's father was my 9th grade teacher in high school. And so all of them, we were all very familiar with each other. We knew each other very well. We were excited that day about two things. One, it was Youth Day.
Yes.
The lesson for that day was a love that forgives. And we were the stars of the program that day. We were the choir. We were the ushers and so forth. The other thing, Cynthia and I were in a social club. We had a meeting scheduled that day at 3 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And our one black local newspaper had allowed us to put an article in the paper, which we thought put us a cut above everybody else that was in a social club. But the article simply said, Cavalette's Club to meet Sunday morning, September 15th at 3 p.m. It gave you the address of where we were meeting, and it listed all of our names in the paper.
That was big time.
That was big time. We were really excited about that. But knowing those two things, Youth Day and our impending club meeting, I rushed upstairs to complete that report.
The girls that morning in the bathroom, what were they doing? Just primping?
They were just primping,
doing their hair,
combing hair, talking. And you know what we don't hear a lot? There were actually 5 girls in the bathroom. I didn't see the 5th person.
Right.
I would learn later that Addie's sister, Sarah, was also still in the bathroom.
But again, at your own home, before you left, you had some responsibilities. You were helping your sister get ready, and you were complaining a little bit about that.
I was.
And tell us about that and the tight ship that your father ran at your house.
Okay.
He didn't mess around.
No, he didn't. He was a very strict disciplinarian. My sister was born when I was about 12 or 13 years old, so she was very much my responsibility. But I loved taking care of her because, you know, it's kind of like having your own baby doll or something. And after having been beat up by 4 boys for a long time, I, you know, really appreciated having that sister there. But she had a lot of hair. And that morning, she would not allow me to comb her hair. And I kept telling my mom she won't let me comb her hair. So my mom said, well, just leave her here.
Just leave her here.
Leave her here with me.
Take off and go.
Right.
Yeah.
And so my father worked 2 jobs all of his life. He taught school by day, but he waited tables by night. Wanted to ensure to the best of his ability that all 6 of us had some opportunities that he did not have. So my father was preparing to go to his weekend job, and my brother was the one that dropped us off.
And he had just turned 16. He was driving a car, and that was a big, big moment for him.
Really big deal for him. And he took us to Sunday school. I took the two younger brothers with me, Alan and Wendell.
Yes.
And put them in their classes. And when I first arrived, I would pass out the reports where you record this information offering in attendance.
Yes.
Then I would sit in my own classroom until about 10:15, and I would go back and collect all of the reports and create the summary. Mm-hmm. And so this is what I did that morning. And, you know, but again, you had asked about my father. My father sort of insisted that we go. The rule around the house was that if you didn't feel like going to church, you probably didn't feel like doing anything else that day, like mm-hmm. playing or visiting mm-hmm. friends. And so we had a lot of rules, but with six children in the house, it meant that things ran a lot more smoothly than they likely would have.
I was just so struck by the fact that the 16th Street Baptist Church, it was central to the life of your family. This was the heartbeat of your family.
Mm-hmm. It really was. I think, let me say that my mother's father was pastor of two churches. So my mother was very church-oriented. And in the summers, I would spend much of my time with my grandparents. We would travel around the rural South doing vacation Bible school at various churches. So it was very central. And when they came to Birmingham, they were in Clanton, a little place called Clanton, where I was born. They moved to Birmingham when I was 2 years old. And that was the first thing they did, was to join the 16th Street Baptist Church. Hmm. And the church is historical in its own right. It was the very first
one.
Black Baptist church that was, well, church of any kind, first black church built in Birmingham, Alabama, 1901. Hmm. And I also like to say that it was built by people who were less than 50 years out of slavery, and they walked in, you know, what this church paid yeah. for. But in our community, this was really a big deal, the church itself. And we would say anybody that was anybody in the black community came to this church. Names you would recognize might be people like W.E.B. Du Bois,
yeah.
Mordecai Johnson, yes. Marian Anderson.
Yes.
And even in later years, and even today, I was there when Tipper Gore came through. In earlier years, our current president, when he was still senator, had an occasion to visit Birmingham. And his one request was to come to the church. And he asked for just time to be there alone. So he didn't get a tour. He didn't get a lecture of any sort. He sat in the sanctuary, I think, and maybe perhaps studied the history and just thought about all that had happened there.
You know, but, one part of the story that was new to me, several parts were, but one thing that I just didn't recall was shortly before the bombing, mm-hmm. you took a telephone call in the church office.
I did.
Incredibly ominous. Mm-hmm. Although at the time, I'm sure you didn't really understand. Mm-hmm. What did the caller say to you? Very simple message. Mm-hmm.
The male caller very simply said, 3 minutes.
3 minutes.
3 minutes. And he hung up.
And you thought what?
I didn't, you know, just big question mark in my head. And even though this was something that I would remember later, but, you know, in the years, days that followed the bombing, all of us that were there were interviewed by the FBI. And so when we did those second and third trials, they pulled my transcript from that period. And apparently when I came in, the woman that I worked under, the clerk, the yeah. church clerk, mentioned to me, I put this in the FBI put it in the transcript, but mentioned that she had gotten a lot of phone calls that morning, and she seemed to be very aggravated.
Referring to you.
Right. Well, mm-hmm. she was just telling me, she was talking out loud, but it really didn't mean anything to me because even though I was aware, I had seen the marching on television, I had seen our newspapers, in the churches and in the privacies of our home, much of that conversation we were excluded from. Mm-hmm. It was nothing to be asked to leave the room if you were at home and they were having that conversation. They had security guards around the church. Our deacons and our trustees were serving as security guards, but none of us knew that. The children were never informed, or no one ever said, be careful, watch for this, or anything.
Birmingham at that time was referred to by some as Bombingham. The notion that bombs would go off in Birmingham wasn't lost on anybody.
Right.
But at that moment, what struck me about the phone call was, what was the point? The caller got a young kid on the line. There wasn't a warning attached to it. It was just this ominous two-word message, 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm. You know, the caller had called earlier. I'm not sure he knew who he was speaking with.
Right, sure.
Yeah, and but as I understand it now, we know much more information after the trials have taken place and we've heard more testimony. As I understand it, those threats had been coming in for quite a while. That was why we placed the deacons and the trustees around the building as guards. When church service was going on Wednesday night, Bible study, they were there.
Yeah.
But we didn't know why. They were just people we knew, and we would see them outside, but we just didn't know as much as the adults knew about what was going on.
Okay. The bomb. It explodes. Where were you?
I was upstairs. I had just taken the phone call that you mentioned, and only because we have media that still comes to the church almost every day, someone asked if I would count the steps from the phone to where I was when the bomb exploded, and we counted 15 steps.
Hmm.
Where the pews began at the beginning of the first aisle, I had gotten that far. I was holding my materials in my arm, and then the windows just came crashing in. I heard it, but initially, you know, I kind of heard from hearing a bomb from the inside is different, a little bit different from the outside. And I know that because they bombed across the street from our home 6 months after
later,
that.
I was going to ask you.
Yeah, but... But I wasn't sure. I wasn't thinking bomb initially when
all
of that happened.
Thunder,
perhaps. Because of that noise I heard, I thought maybe it was just thunder in the sky or something. But when the glasses in the church came crashing in, then I heard people scream, and I heard someone say, hit the floor. And we had hardwood floors then. The church is carpeted today. But within probably 30 seconds, you could hear feet hitting those hardwood floors, and I just knew something was wrong. As we all made our way outside, it wasn't until we were outside that we fully recognized what had happened, that the church had been bombed.
I was so surprised to read your account of it, because as you're suggesting here, it wasn't as loud as you might imagine it was. It was muffled, I think, is the word you might have used in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting word to associate with the sound of a bomb going off. Yeah,
it wasn't muffled on the outside. My father, who by this time had just arrived at his second job, heard it, but it wasn't an uncommon thing. But once he walked in the building, his fellow employees said, you know, they just bombed your church. And my father got back in the car.
Mm.
We only had one car. He got back in the car and turned around and came back to where we were. The other thing is this. Now, in 2008, I worked on a campaign to renovate the church.
Mm-hmm.
We raised $4 million and during that same period of time, the church was declared a National Historic Landmark. I did have the privilege of speaking before the Department of the Interior. But we brought in three architects to evaluate the church. And those architects said, this church is just supremely well built. You know, it had a few water drainage problems and all. But they surmised that if it had not been as well built as it was, as sturdy and sound as it was, that clearly more people would have died.
Carolyn Moll McKinstry is my guest. She's a survivor of the 16th Baptist Church bombing back in 1963 in Birmingham, Alabama. She'll be speaking at 6:15 this evening at Avila University, 11901 Warnell Road. She's speaking as part of the Harry S. Truman Distinguished Lecture Series. At 4 o'clock this afternoon, there'll be a town hall forum titled Peace and Civil Rights in Kansas City, Past, Present, and Future. The forum will feature Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, Al Brooks, The Stars, Mary Sanchez, and others. More information, avila.edu. So, Carolyn, you get outside, and that's when it really begins to hit you. You see blood on faces, and you know something is very wrong.
Mm-hmm. I was just a lot startled looking around at people walking around. And my first thought went to those two little brothers that I brought with
me. You couldn't find them at first.
I couldn't find them. And as you mentioned earlier, my father was very strict. There was no such thing as I don't know where he is. And so I knew that I could not leave until I found those two little boys. Mm-hmm. It would be a long search. And in fact, I didn't find them. One, they went in two opposite directions.
Yes.
Yeah, one was just accosted the first adult male that he saw.
Couldn't let him go.
Wouldn't let him go. He was the six-year-old. He was so frightened. And the other brother my father encountered as he drove from that second job back to the church to look for us. He knew that my mother couldn't get there. We only had the one car. So he came back to find us.
I got to speed up. We just have a few minutes left. But as the years passed, you had trouble talking about this. It wasn't talked about much. Why? It was such a monumental event. Why weren't people talking about it more?
You know, I think just the notion that the depths of the hatred, the notion of what people were willing to do in the name of maintaining the status quo or a certain way of life. No one talked about anything. I went to school. The bombing was on Sunday, September 15th. Monday morning, I was in school. There was no memorial service. There was no moment of silent prayer. There was no special assembly to talk about anything.
Life just went on like
life
nothing
went
had happened.
On. And even when we renovated the church, don't you know, we created a wall in front of that bathroom. And so if you visit the church today, you can't walk in the space where the girls were. There's just a wall there now. And so it was a very deliberate attempt, I think, to minimize the pain and the remembrance that we would have.
But
when
you
we
lost
came
your
back.
Best friend, Carolyn.
I did.
14 years old to a bombing.
I was devastated. I was devastated. I struggled with that for over 20 years, you know, remembering the friends that had died, being awakened 6 months later at 3 a.m. to another bomb that crashed
in
all
your
the
neighborhood.
Windows,
yeah.
windows in and everything. It was a tremendous struggle, something that back then we would have, today we would call depression. We didn't have a name for it then. People just thought you were different. You know, you were quiet or you were different. But it was a tremendous struggle to overcome.
Well, Carolyn Maule McKinstry tells this story in great detail. While the world watched, a Birmingham bombing survivor comes of age during the civil rights movement. Again, you can see and hear her this evening at 6:15 at Avila University. More information about that event, just go to avila.edu. It's open to the public. And Carolyn, I'm still glad you're here. Thanks for coming and sharing just an amazing story. We sure appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
All the best.
I'm delighted to have been invited.
Thank you. Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Brian McTavish is here talking about cool stuff to do this weekend and kind of a sober introduction to your arrival here today. What a story she had to tell.
What a tale.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah.
And it's, well, you know what it's time for?
Yeah.
Group love.
Well, I guess that's probably right.
Let's go to some group love.
And your point is?
My point is?
Group love is the name of this group.
Pop Rock Happiness. Supplied by Group Love, L.A. Quintet, a quintet. That's five, right? Five.
Yeah.
7 o'clock. Right. 7 o'clock.
Uno, dos, tres.
Cuatro, cinco, seis.
There you go.
And that's it. That's all I got.
Thank you,
elementary school.
Yeah.
Okay, 7 o'clock, Friday night, live, where else but the KC Live stage at Kansas City Power and Light downtown. Here's the story on group love. It's a long story, but we only have a short time, so allow me to try to be as succinct as
possible.
I'm
glad we understand each other here.
They're based in L.A. now, but the whole kit and caboodle started out in New York when singer Christian Zacconi bumped into artist Hannah Hooper.
Mm-hmm.
Hannah Hooper winds up on the Greek island of Crete with Christian, but...
Are we going somewhere with this?
That's up to you
Crete
and me.
Crete and these people, yeah.
Okay, these two, they show up on this in this communal kind of artistic community, right? And they meet the other members of the band-to-be.
And Group Love came to
Group Love, and they came to be. She still paints or draws the covers to the band's albums. And this is their song, Welcome to Your Life. Welcome to a good time Friday night at the KC Life stage.
It's that time of year. Man, yeah, no kidding.
All right, well...
This is an interesting idea. I had not heard of this.
Well, yeah, they do it every year. Of course, we have our haunted houses in the West Bottoms, right?
And, here's a different idea.
Here's a different idea. The haunted tour of Fort Leavenworth, right? That's the oldest... excuse me. I'm getting all choked up.
Yeah. Oldest military base, what, west of the Mississippi?
The oldest military base. Thank you very much. Host,
is that right?
Well, that is right, actually. That's what it says. Right. So at 6 o'clock on Saturday night, you can check in. And by 7 o'clock, you'll be walking around Fort Leavenworth, starting with the old disciplinary barracks, okay? So what happened at Fort Leavenworth that might produce some evil spirits?
I don't know.
Or some upset
people
dead people.
People have been hung there and stuff, I think.
Well, yeah. Funny you should mention that, because I find this hard to believe. I guess they were still hanging people there.
The In Cold Blood guys were hung there, I
think.
Well,
that's right.
Am I right about that?
That's two in a row.
Am I doing your research for you?
I think you're doing it all for me.
Yeah.
Okay, so anyway, you will hear stories of and perhaps even see some of the departed souls, including executed prisoners. One time they had to execute 12 or 14 prisoners. This is during World War II. There was a prison uprising. They offed a lot of these guys, right? But they didn't have enough gallows. So they had to go to some administration building, and there's an elevator shaft there, believe it or not, and they used, and I'm not sure I do, but they used the elevator shaft.
No.
They say you can still hear the screams coming from the elevator shaft. And then you'll walk around to various dwellings, former dwellings, and you might see some other people running around who are not really alive. So go check this out. Whether or not you believe in ghosts, believe it. You'll have a good time.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 emotional things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org.
We recently married, only 9 months, so we've been having a lot of sex, a lot of fudging and wedging and lotions and potions and unguents and poultices and jams and jellies and sauces and salices and mustards and custards and foams and soups and smoothing milks and hustle bustle, hustle bustle, hustle bustle, hammer, anvil, hammer, anvil, hammer, anvil! Nothing's been consummated, but we've been doing some furious hand-holding, and our palms are raw with desire.
That's Maria Bamford.
And what do you think she's describing
there? Well, I got it, I think. Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay, go for 3 in a row. What's she talking about?
No, you tell me.
Okay, you're not too sure yourself.
Yeah.
That she recently got married.
Well, that's what she said.
Did she say that?
She said that.
Okay, and she was describing
the early months of what they do.
Isn't it funny how young lovers do what young lovers do? Anyway, Maria Bamford, very funny gal, stand-up comedy, 7:30 Thursday, Folly Theater. She does a lot of crazy, funny cartoon voices on shows.
People like her a lot.
Oh, no, she's just so gifted. You've seen her on Louie and maybe Arrested Development. She does her own primetime TV comedy specials. Highly recommended. You're going to laugh. She's a twitchy, weird, zany character, not tied to reality.
That's
funny. Not situational.
And you can get tickets, still.
Oh, yeah. Actually, more than a few tickets left. So there's an opportunity to treat you and yours to a funny night at the Folly.
What do we have going on here?
We got a great idea here. It's called Sci-Flix, as in sci-fi flicks. Sci-Flix, a date night with your brain.
Wow.
which doesn't sound that exciting, but let me continue. Screening and discussion of the 1985 sci-fi film, the best and original version of that film, RoboCop. It kicks off at 6:30 Friday at Renier Hall Auditorium at the University of Kansas Edwards campus, right there at 126.
Renier Hall.
And is it Renier?
Yeah.
Oh, there's your third one right there.
There you go, right
three
there.
In a row.
There
anyway,
you go.
They'll explore some of the ethics and technologies. They'll have KU professors there who will watch the film with you and then talk about could it happen, might it happen. It'll be fascinating.
And finally today.
Casper, the friendly ghost, the friendliest ghost you know. Though grown-ups might look at him.
Let's get Casper going.
Do kids today even know who the heck
they don't
Casper
know who
is?
Casper is, of course not.
I guess they made kind of a not so hot live action movie not some years ago. Anyway, I remember Casper as that super friendly cartoon kitty ghost. And they're met, you know, hey, if I go, I'll try to wear a costume that evokes the Casper mythos. It's the Halloween extravaganza, totally family friendly Halloween celebration with costume contests and music and dancing and candy, 1 to 6 Saturday, this Saturday, where else but Municipal Auditorium. $9 for everybody, except if you're 12 months or younger, it's free.
Wow.
It's free.
That's Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks, Casper.
Tomorrow, Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Jason Kander will be here in the studio. He's looking to unseat incumbent Roy Blunt. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, Ryan Hennessy, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.